MacCast, Tuesday, October 8th, 2013. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Glad to be back here with you for another episode. We got a lot of great stuff to talk about this time around. Actually, something frustrating to some people out there, some of you out there, iOS is making some people sick. We're going to get into that a little bit. We're going to talk about Apple's next quarterly results call, which will be coming up here in a couple weeks. Also, we have a date, or very likely a date, on Apple's next big event happening this month here in October. Rumors on the iWatch and iTunes Radio expanding. Also, we've got some great feedback, some of your feedback on the iPhone 5S. There's a new podcast app out for those of you in the UK, which might be a little bit shocking. You wouldn't think there's a regional podcast player, but apparently there is now. And also, we're going to be talking about Can You Run Mavericks? Mavericks should be coming out soon, along with some fingerprint tips. So, lots of great stuff to dive into and get into in this episode. But before we get into all of that, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that's CrashPlan. You know, I am a huge fan of CrashPlan. I've been using CrashPlan for years, so that it's like having this sponsor is like a dream for me because I love their product. It is truly one of those things where I bought the service, I set it up, and I didn't have to think about it. It just runs on my system. It does my backups, puts all of my home folder content, all the stuff that I want, up into the cloud, safe on their secure servers. It's offsite. I don't have to worry about natural disasters, catastrophes if my house burns down. That is my offsite backup solution. And if you don't have an offsite backup solution, you really should take a look at CrashPlan right now. What I absolutely love about it is that it just runs on my computer. So you sign up for the service, you download the software, you install it, you configure it, you set it up exactly how you want it. You can tweak out how much bandwidth it's doing, what it's doing in the background. You can schedule it so that it happens when your machine is more idle, if you're worried about processor cycles. But you really don't have to be worried about it because I have mine just set up with the defaults right out of the box, and I never even notice it. It takes a while for that first backup to happen because you are going over the internet. And if you're going to back up, say, your entire home folder, that can take a little bit. But once it's done, it's just doing incremental backups and it's continuous. It's minute to minute. It's secure. It's offsite. You don't have to think about it anymore. And it just couldn't be easier to set it up. So if you're worried that it's too complicated, that sort of stuff, don't worry about that stuff. You're going to be protected and covered by CrashPlan. And plus, the service is really affordable. One of the reasons I went with CrashPlan originally is because, one, they have great family pricing, so it'll cover all of your computers. Also, their service covers not just your internal drive, but also all of your external drives, your network drives. Everything can be put into your CrashPlan. They have unlimited storage options, so you don't have to worry about how much you're putting up there. And it is just amazing. The service for a year cost me about the price of an external hard drive to cover all of my Macs. I'm on a family plan. They also have other plans that are single plans, a little bit less expensive. So you can check out the full offering over at CrashPlan.com. But really, don't wait any longer. If you've been holding off on offsite backup, just head over, check out CrashPlan. I think you're really going to like it, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So it turns out that for some people, the look of iOS 7 is actually making them physically ill, physically sick. And I'm not talking about just the flat redesign and just a general opinion on the color palette. No, what we're actually talking about is the motion and the movement and just the overall fluidness of the operating system actually giving people motion sickness. And there's been a lot of reports and commentary on these stories over the last week or so, and it's run the gamut from people saying it's a pandemic, an epidemic of pandemic proportions, all the way through some people being completely dismissive, saying this is ridiculous. How could, you know, the operating system be making people actually sick? And as is always the case with these kinds of stories, I think the truth lies somewhere in the middle. I think the fact is that iOS 7 really does make liberal use of these animations and transparency. It's got a lot of motion to it. And you add in things like the parallax effect on the desktop to give that kind of 3D look. And I think for some people that can cause a little bit of discomfort all the way through downright motion sickness. And some people are more sensitive to these sorts of things than others. You know, it's that 3D parallax kind of effect. And it's not just OS 7. There's other operating systems, other mobile operating systems, desktop operating systems that can have this kind of impact on people. As a matter of fact, it impacts about 5% of the population, according to some experts. They suffer from this kind of vertigo, this kind of motion sickness or these kinds of feelings where they can get dizziness and yes, can even become physically ill from this kind of motion being on the screen or on their devices. And it, again, runs the gamut from being really extreme for some people to mild for others. It's like my wife is actually mildly impacted by the motion effects in iOS and in OS X to the point where she has to physically turn away from her screen when some of the zooming effects and things like that are going on because it just gives her a headache. It makes her feel uncomfortable. She doesn't get ill or dizzy, but just really doesn't like it. And I guess according to a lot of the reports, it seems to affect people who have trouble reading in the car. If you get car sickness while you're reading in the car, and this is something my wife suffers from as well, you seem to be more prone to having iOS 7 kind of make you have similar kinds of feelings. And so I think it's not good for anybody to sort of discount this. And if you think about Apple, Apple prides itself on being accessible, making its devices work for a large number of people, including people who have certain kinds of disabilities. That's what universal access is all about and the accessibility features. But with iOS 7, they've sort of seemed to miss a pretty significant group here with this potential issue. They do provide some settings for allowing you to reduce motion. I think we've talked about where those are. If you go into the accessibility options, there's a toggle switch that says reduce motion. But really, the only thing that does is disable the parallax effect on the screen. It does not do anything to reduce the amount of animation, specifically for like opening up your phone, unlocking your phone, launching applications. You know, you get that kind of zooming through layers kind of thing. And I think that's what's doing it for a lot of people. So I hope that Apple kind of listens to this story and these stories and sees what's going on and maybe gives some better options for reducing some of the animations, both in iOS and in OS X. I've also already commented that I think, in general, the animations are a little bit too slow, so I don't know if that further compounds the effect. If you've noticed, the zooming effect is really obvious in iOS 7. Maybe if it was a little bit faster, if it transitioned a little bit quicker, I don't know if that would be better or worse for these people. I know for me, I would just feel like my system was running faster. It almost makes the operating system, to me, feel slower than it is. So I'm hoping Apple will step up and address these issues. We've already been hearing rumors that Apple is seeding iOS 7, 7.0.3. They came out last week with the 7.0.2 update. They've put a 7.0.3 version out to workers and internal partners for testing. I doubt that they're going to be addressing the motion sickness thing here yet. One likely thing we'll see in the update, though, is there's a couple of bugs that are pretty severe. Maybe some of you have run into them with the current version of iOS 7. Apple's already acknowledged a problem with iMessages. I actually have had this happen where you try and send an iMessage and it either goes unsent or you don't receive an iMessage, or in some cases, your iMessage goes out as an SMS, as a text message, instead of an iMessage. Apple confirmed that there is a problem there. It's something they're aware of impacting some users, and they are working on that. So I would expect that to be in the 7.0.3 update. I'm also hoping another fix will be, we had a lot of reports this week of miscalibrated sensors, and nobody really knows if this is a hardware or software thing. I think from a lot of the reports that I was seeing, it seems like more it's something that Apple could address in software, specifically with the iPhone 5S and maybe the new M7 coprocessor. But people have noticed that the new level feature, which is part of the Compass app. So if you go into the Compass, it now actually has a level. But when you compare that to actually a physical real-world level, it's off by about 2 or 3 degrees. And by the same token, there's also some issues with the Compass itself. That seems to be off by about 8 to 10 degrees on the iPhone 5S. So that's pretty significant. I wouldn't necessarily want to rely on my iPhone 5S at this point for getting me out of the woods if the Compass is off that far. But again, hopefully this is something that Apple can tweak in the software. Hopefully it's just a miscalibration issue, and that is part of the 7.0.3 update, the next update as well. The other thing I'm hoping Apple will address is Siri. Siri could really use some help. I don't know about you, but I am constantly getting the message when I activate Siri, sorry, I can't help you right now, and I have to access Siri 2 or 3 times before I can actually get it to go through. And that was something that started happening to me in the late beta builds. I was part of the developer program. Siri was working fine, and then sort of like the last or second to last build, I started having this issue. And I think it's not impacting everybody. I don't know if it's regional or what the actual trigger is, but it's certainly something I've run into, and I've seen other reports of that online. But Apple is expected to be putting out another update to iOS 7 relatively soon. Probably not addressing the motion sickness stuff yet, but hopefully that'll come in a future update as well. We're getting close to Apple's next quarterly results call. As a matter of fact, they announced that they are going to be going over their fourth fiscal quarter results for 2013 on Monday, October 28th. They're going to have that live conference call that they do. You can actually listen in on that. If you go to Apple's website, they have a QuickTime feed that you can listen in, and you can hear Peter Oppenheimer, the CFO, and Tim Cook talking about how Apple did with their numbers for the quarter. And even though the iPhone was out late in the quarter, I think it was on sale just for about 10 days before the end of the quarter, we know that Apple sold about 9 million in that opening weekend, 9 million plus units of the iPhone 5S and 5C. So fully expect those to make a big impact on Apple's numbers, even though it was late in the quarter. As a matter of fact, Apple did up their guidance to investors just based on those sales numbers. They said they expect to see about $37 billion in revenue for the quarter. That was on the higher end of their guidance to investors. So we'll see how all that stuff breaks down in terms of the numbers for individual products and devices, Macs versus iPhones versus laptops and stuff like that. Also, I would expect Apple's cash hoard to have grown significantly. As a matter of fact, at the end of the June quarter, Apple's cash reserve was at $146.6 billion. And according to the Wall Street Journal, that accounted for 10% of all of the cash held by U.S. non-financial companies. So Apple has about 10% of all the cash held by non-financial companies here in the U.S., that's an impressive number. And I guess that was up from about 9.5%. So I expect that to go up even a little bit more with the next quarterly results. But we'll be listening in on that call and giving you coverage after that, the end of the month here on the MacCast. And speaking of events, All Things Digital came out, and they finally put a date on Apple's next media event. You can circle October 22nd on your calendar. That is a Tuesday. Now, Apple hasn't officially announced it, and as a matter of fact, up until this week, we had been hearing some rumor sites throwing out that October 15th might have been the date, but now considering we're less than a week away from that and invites haven't gone out to the media, they generally go out about a week in advance, I think we can scratch that one off. All Things D actually has a pretty good track record of predicting the event dates, and add to that we got a yep from the Loop's bearded one, Jim Dalrymple. That yep, you can pretty much book your travel arrangements on. So it's almost a certainty at this point that October 22nd is the date we're going to hear about Apple's next generation iPads, both the full-size 9.7-inch model and an updated iPad mini model. if the Mini is going to feature a Retina display or not. That's been the subject of a lot of debate in the media over the past month. Some have been going so far as to say that Apple won't be releasing an iPad Mini Retina display update this year, that it would happen in 2014. My take on it, and I think I've commented on this a couple times, is that Apple will have a Retina iPad Mini this year, will be announced at that October event. If it isn't, then I say there's no iPad Mini update at all. It's either an all or nothing sort of thing. And my money is on that Apple has a Retina iPad Mini ready to go. The main rumor has been that there have been yield issues with the Retina displays, that Apple's been having trouble getting those from their suppliers. I actually call BS on that, because even Tim Cook said in the last, I think it was the last quarterly results call, or it might have been the one before that, that he cautioned analysts basically about speculating against Apple's supply chain and, you know, basing rumors or what Apple might be doing on any given metric coming out of the supply chain, because Apple uses a lot of different suppliers. You know, they use more than one supplier, and it can be very easy to misinterpret the data that's coming out from any one source. And I think we've seen that historically. We'll hear rumors based on what's happening in the supply chain, and they turn out not to be true. Also, just with the Retina display, Apple's competitors have high-resolution, high-density displays out there. I can't imagine that Apple, of all people, is having trouble getting suppliers to put those out there. Now, Apple has some technologies that are exclusive to their displays, and you know, maybe with the digitizers and the layering and you know, the single touch layers and things like that, it's a little bit trickier for Apple's suppliers to put those displays together. But I just don't buy that. I think worst case scenario is we're going to have constrained supplies at launch, but we always have that. That's nothing new. We've also been getting those rumors, right? That, oh my gosh, iPad Mini supplies are going to be constrained at launch. Really? When has that not happened? My wild speculation for the event overall, I'm going to make my predictions. You're going to be able to, after the event, rate me, write this down, mark it down. Here are my predictions. So, fifth generation iPad with Retina display, a new thinner design with styling matching the current iPad Mini styling. So, the colors are going to be matching the iPhone 5S, the design matching the iPad Mini design. So, you know, the rounded, more kind of squared off, thinner design, silver and white color, space gray and black, and yes, also the gold and white that's been so popular with the 5S. I think Apple's going to carry that over into the iPad lineup. Updated 64-bit A7, I'm going to say A7X processor, the M7 coprocessor, upgraded GPU, longer battery life, and Apple adding in the Touch ID sensor to the fifth generation iPad with Retina display. For the Retina iPad Mini, they're going to update the colors to match the ones in the iPhone 5S. So once again, silver and white, space gray and black, and the gold. An updated A6 processor in the iPad Mini. M7 coprocessor, I'm going to say that's going to be in there. Also, updated GPU, longer battery life, and the Touch ID on the iPad Mini as well. I think Apple's going to go Touch ID across the board. I'm not convinced they'll go 64-bit on the iPad Mini. I'm going to say no on. I think they're just going to go with an A6 processor in the Mini. And both iPads are expected to get an improved 8-megapixel larger aperture EyeSight camera. I think that's very likely going to be something Apple's going to do. I've seen too many people in the wild being iPad photographers. You know, I made fun of this when it first came out, but I see it all the time now. It's people are using the camera that they have on them, and Apple, I think, wants to make sure that people have the best possible camera on them that they can have. So I think we will get an upgraded camera system, EyeSight camera system, in the next generations of iPads. And then at that event also, I'm expecting Apple to announce pricing and the release date for the Mac Pro. I don't think there's going to be any new additions to the Mac Pro lineup. I think we pretty much know what those machines are going to look like. Apple's just going to fill in the holes in terms of pricing and options and that sort of stuff, and when they're actually going to start putting them on sale. As far as when the iPads will go on sale, I think Apple's going to start pre-sales on the Friday following the event, so Friday, October 25th. Also, I think that'll be the announcement and release date for OS X Mavericks. I think that'll go on sale Friday, October 25th. So Friday following the event, you'll be able to go on to the store and download it. Again, this is just all my wild hair speculation. I'm just making this stuff up. I don't have any internal sources. It's just my gut feeling on the thing. And then I think pre-sales on the 25th with the iPads actually shipping starting November 1st, which I think would be a little bit late for Apple, but since they're having the event so much further or later in the month, I think that's what's going to happen. I guess there could be the possibility that they put the iPads actually on sale in store on Friday, October 25th, but I think they're going to want to have that lead time and take a little bit of pre-sales to kind of jazz things up. But, you know, it's good for marketing. It's good for sort of setting up the hype and getting people excited about the upcoming product. And of course, OS X Mavericks hasn't hit the streets yet. It has gone Gold Master, but we're already getting reports of the next generation of OS X being sighted in the wild. It's macOS X 10.10, and it's codenamed Syrah. Obviously, at this early stage, nobody has any details on anything beyond the version number and the code name, but there's a pretty good bet that Apple is going to, at least on the UI side, borrow heavily from the look of iOS 7. And if that news is upsetting to you right now, you've got about a year to get used to the idea, or maybe start making your plans to move to something like, I don't know, Windows 8. Do you really want to go there? Is the thought of having iOS 7 styling in macOS 10 going to drive you to Windows? I hope not. It's not going to drive me to Windows. iOS 7's growing on me. I actually like it in a lot of ways. I still wish they would be a little bit more obvious about the buttons, maybe give us some button borders. But beyond that, I like overall the flatter look of iOS 7, and I'll be interested to see how Apple transitions that over onto the desktop. But, you know, I think we'll in a year have some time for iOS 7 to mature, and we'll get a more sophisticated, mature version in OS 10. Rumors of the iWatch are back, or the non-existent iWatch, as I'm calling it. This time around, it's a Korean publication claiming that Apple is testing at least 3 different iWatch designs based around flexible OLED displays. And that's where the rumor fell apart for me. I don't think that's what's going on. According to them, they say the designs are reportedly for 1.3, 1.4, and 1.5-inch displays that would be curved to better conform to the shape of your wrist. I think if Apple does do a wrist-type wearable with a screen, there's good odds that it's going to be curved glass. I'm just not convinced that it's going to be OLED. Apple's never been big on the OLED technology, but, you know, who knows? Maybe they'll go that route for their wearable. But here's the real deal. Can we stop calling it an iWatch? The watch concept has been proven, in my opinion, to be a complete non-starter. I have a Pebble. I got a Pebble so I could see, you know, what the iWatch experience was like. And the technology is darn cool. I think some of the technology in the Samsung Gear watch is very, very interesting. But there seems to be no consumer demand for that kind of product. It just seems flat, dead in the water. And Apple is not going to make something that doesn't delight and excite and amaze consumers. So they're simply not going to make a smartwatch. I'm not precluding Apple from making a wearable, don't get me wrong, but it's going to be much smarter, much more amazing, much broader than just simply a smartwatch. I also don't think that any kind of wearable product that Apple would do is going to be tied to some other device. I think it's going to be able to operate autonomously. It's going to be its own product. I think the functionality could be extremely enhanced by connecting to an iOS device or a Mac, but I think it'll also stand on its own and not be completely dependent upon it like a lot of the products that are hitting the market right now. You've got to attach a lot of the smartwatches and connect them to some other device. I think Apple's not going to go that route. So I'm not putting too much stock in quote-unquote iWatch rumors Apple wearable rumors, I'd like to see some more creative thinking in that regard. And I'll probably report more on those stories when they start popping up. iTunes Radio is already getting ready to expand. It's barely out of its infancy, but Bloomberg says that Apple's preparing to expand iTunes Radio in the iTunes Radio service outside the U.S., so that's good news for a number of countries. Reportedly, they plan to roll out the service to Canada, the U.K., several of the Nordic countries, Australia, and New Zealand sometime soon, probably early next year from the rumors. The story says that Apple already has a number of their international deals in place with most, if not all, of the big three music labels. So really, at this point, it's just about them prepping the service, getting the servers and the infrastructure ready to take on the load when they start rolling that out. Rapid international expansion could really actually help Apple's new service, I think, capture market share a lot more quickly. Pandora, for example, they haven't done much outside of the U.S. yet, so Apple could really gain a lot of traction with iTunes Radio more easily, I think, outside the U.S. There's less competition. They can start to pull in more subscribers, more listeners, and more ears means more money for their advertising revenue. As a matter of fact, Apple Senior Vice President of Internet Software and Services, Eddie Q, said when they launched iTunes Radio that he wanted the service to eventually grow into more than 100 countries. Of course, they didn't comment on how that was going to be done, the timeline, how rapidly it was going to be done. But it sounds like Apple wants to move pretty quickly on this. You know, in new markets, the bottom line is Apple makes money off of the free version of the service by selling ads. It's 100% ad supported. They've already lined up some pretty big advertisers, companies like Nissan and McDonald's, Pepsi, Procter and Gamble. And they've already reportedly begun an advertising program trying to bring in programmers or advertisers for the Canadian version of the service. And that's where some of these rumors are being fueled from. So Apple is also going to use the iTunes Radio service, or is starting to use the iTunes Radio service to aggressively promote and help people find and discover new music and promote new artists and albums. As a matter of fact, they recently released iTunes Radio versions. You can stream the entire album, new album from Justin Timberlake, or you could. You can now, right now, I think, stream Miley Cyrus's new album completely for free on the service. And then, of course, you can buy it through iTunes. So I think iTunes Radio is going to be a big, big deal for Apple. And the rapid expansion of the service internationally is a really good thing for them to be concentrating on. And it's going to be much quicker than the rollout for some of their other services. If you remember how long it took them to get TV shows rolled out internationally, this is a much more aggressive schedule. Even if they just get it into the international English-speaking countries, which it seems to be that's what they're targeting first. But if they can get out to 100 countries in a couple years, that would be an amazing rollout, and I think they would grab a lot of market share. I am a huge fan of the iTunes Radio service. I've been using it, again, since I was running the beta software, and I absolutely love it. I think I'm a little bit slanted towards it against something like Pandora. I was a big fan of Pandora. The ads got to be a little bit much for me. And with iTunes Radio, because I am an iTunes Match subscriber, I get it ad-free. And I really, really appreciate that. And for $25 a year, I think it's really worth it. I'm discovering a lot of new music. I like some of the customizations you can do. I like being able to slide that slider over and say, you know, I want to hear more obscure stuff. I want it more in discovery mode so I can find new artists and things that I like. I've been adding stuff to my playlists. I've bought even a few things. So I know for me, it's actually generated more iTunes sales. It's caused me to buy a couple more iTunes songs. I was already somebody who bought music on iTunes, but now I'm buying even a little bit more. So I think iTunes Radio is going to be a good thing. I'm curious, are you using iTunes Radio? Has it changed your buying habits? And for those people in the U.S. and hopefully for those of you outside the U.S., you're going to have the service in the new year. The rumor is stating that it's expected to happen sometime in early 2014, at least for the first round of countries, and then I would imagine more rollouts throughout the year. And then finally in the news for this week, for those of you who have been holding out for a larger screen iPhone, it's sounding like it's on the way. Now, the 5S and 5C aren't even potty trained yet, but the rumor mills are already grinding out the iPhone 6 rumors. The sad thing is that they aren't even really new rumors. They're just taking the old rumors that didn't work for the 5S and 5C and pushing them on to the next iPhone. And the big news flash, I let slip the lead. The big news, ready for it? The iPhone, the sixth generation, is going to have a bigger screen, finally. I know, phew. Apple dodged a bullet on that one, right? but don't worry, it's not going to be a bigger screen. It's going to be a tiny bigger screen. Apple is said to be going with a 4.8-inch panel, according to one source, so they're not going to have the same kind of gigantophone screens as some of their competitors who are pushing into that 6-inch plus territory. They're just going to start out in the, the 4.X kind of territory. So they're catching up with Android phones like 2 years ago. Maybe even bigger. Display Search is actually citing rumors are claiming that Apple has been testing not only 4.7-inch displays, but also 5.7-inch versions. And the larger version is actually in a resolution pushing full 1080p HD quality. So that's getting close to a 6-inch screen. But again, if they're testing, they could just be playing around with form factors. That doesn't necessarily mean that's what they're going to put out. An often reliable analyst, Ming-Chi Kuo, said he expects the iPhone 6 to have a 4.5 to 5-inch display, so falling in that range. It'll be interesting to see if Apple sticks with a 4-inch option as well. My gut instinct is that if they're going to go to a new display size, they're going to go to that across the board. Maybe they'll leave the 5C or the next generation of the 5C at the smaller screen size and then just push up the higher-end version, the 6, to a larger display. But I know a lot of people really like the larger displays. I have mixed feelings on it. It's growing on me as someone who's getting older and whose eyesight is failing him a little bit more as he ages. I can see the advantage of having a larger screen with a little bit larger type, but I don't think that's something that everybody wants. I do like the fact that my iPhone still fits in my pocket and that I can pretty much cover the whole screen one-handed without too much hand jockeying around. So what do you think? Are you in that? If Apple just had a bigger iPhone, I would upgrade, or you think this is going to, convince people to move over from Android who have these other devices? I think Apple's probably not going large enough for some consumers, but I just don't want one of those giant phones. I see people out there, and it looks like they have a freaking iPad mini slapped to their head. It just looks ridiculous. Am I wrong? I don't know. Anyway, that does it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show's sponsors. Speaking of new phones, if you want one of those new iPhones, the new iPhones are here, and you know you want one. Guess what? Gazelle.com. Gazelle wants to buy your old phone. They want to give you cash for it, and that can be cash that you can use to offset the purchase or maybe even cover the purchase of your new device. As a matter of fact, I just sold my iPhone 4 and 4S on Gazelle, and it paid for my new iPhone 5S. And the process really could not be easier. You just go to gazelle.com. That's gazelle.com. You tell them what kind of device you have. You answer a few questions about the conditions, the kind of accessories you have. They'll even buy broken iPhones. So don't worry if you have a broken one. You just let them know what you have, and you will get a risk-free offer, and they'll even pay for the shipping and in some cases send you a box. I actually went for that option. I had them send me a box, came in the mail within a couple days. I had everything I needed to do. There was great instructions. It had a label in there. All I had to do was take my old iPhones and the accessories, put them in the box, slap on the label, send it back, and within a few days, I got paid really quickly. Now, you can get paid by check. You can get paid by PayPal. I went with the Amazon gift card option because you get 5% more on your offer, and I'm a huge Amazon customer. I have Amazon Prime, so it just went right into my Amazon account. And again, totally simple, easy way to get paid. So the benefits are you get paid fast within a couple days of them receiving your device. They will wipe your data for free. They've paid out more than $100 million to over 600,000 customers. So they're a reputable service. They've been doing this for a long time. You can get free shipping and even qualify for a free box in some cases. So what are you waiting for? Just go over to gazelle.com now, get an offer for your old iPhone, and do it today, because the longer you wait, devices start to go down in value. So the quicker you do it, the more cash you can get for that old device, and you can use that to buy your new iPhone. Gazelle.com, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So speaking about the new iPhones, I got some great feedback from Gavin in the UK. I just love the UK accent, so I'm half playing this just because it came from one of our UK listeners. But Gavin had some great comments about his experience buying his new iPhone 5S, and he made some great comments about the 5C as well. So here's Gavin.
Hi, Adam. This is Gavin calling from the UK. I just thought I would drop in and give you my experiences of buying and using the 5S for the last few days. Seems I was one of the lucky ones. Unbelievably, I walked into my local to where I work, which was in central London, mobile phone store on the Monday following the Friday release, when everything was allegedly sold out everywhere. Inquired as to how many months I had left on my current contract, so seeing when I could upgrade. And as it turned out, I had less than I thought, could pay off my contract for about £60. But unbelievably, the guy said to me, "Okay, well, we can do it now if you like." Yes, they had some iPhones. They'd had a delivery. They had Space Gray. They had the white and silver. And they had the gold. So I bought the Space Gray. 64 gig. And I have to say, I have come from an iPhone 4S, and I absolutely love it. It, for me, is a quantum leap. Obviously, incredibly quick compared to my previous model. The main features that are standing out for me are the camera and the video camera, which both of which I love very much. The camera is vastly improved over the 4S. I haven't had a massive amount of time to take a lot of stills, but certainly what I've taken look vastly improved, so I'm loving that. The slow-mo video, I just love. I do a lot of video stuff anyway. I can see myself using that an awful lot, filming, you know, dog, children, various bits and pieces, and I'm just loving that, and I'm going to get a lot of fun out of that, I think. I have to say, on seeing the new models for the first time, which was on that day, if the iPhone 5C had carried the specs of the iPhone 5S, i.e. the faster processor, the better optics, etc., etc., I have no hesitation in saying that I would have picked up a blue 5C, because despite the lovely design of these 5Ss, and they are great, I've loved the sort of design since the 4, the iPhone 5C, from the couple of times that I've handled it, and I've seen it now a couple of times since and had a play around with one, is for me the nicest iPhone Apple have ever made. I think it is phenomenal, absolutely wonderful phone, and I'm quite actually tempted to even buy one as well and use it as an iPod, just because it is so aesthetically lovely to use and to have in the hand. That's it, really. It's been an interesting few days. I really, really love it. I bought myself a black leather Apple case, which I'm also loving. I don't normally put my phones in cases, but it's a really lovely case. I really, really like it, and I can't see myself taking it off. Looking forward to the iPad update, possibly next week. It's interesting. I would, you know what, I think if it were me, I would go down the route of the full-size iPads, yeah, do the silver, do the space grey, gold, I don't know, in an iPad particularly. However, the iPad mini, if I was going to be in charge of what that was going to be and how it was going to look, I would launch the second generation iPad mini wrapped in the shell casing of the iPhone 5C, that unapologetic plastic. I think if they knocked those out in the various blues, yellows, pinks and whites, they would absolutely fly off the shelves. So anyway, that's my thoughts. Really love it. Nice to be able to contribute. I hope you keep carrying on, and just a big shout out to yourself, who I've listened to for many years, and the fellow Mac enthusiasts and terrific podcasters over in the US, including John and Dave over at the Geek Gab, Katie and Dave at Power Users, and everyone else who makes being a Mac and iOS user such a delight, because it's such a great community. So keep on keeping on. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, thanks, Gavin. And, you know, it's the community that makes this thing awesome. You're absolutely right. So I appreciate all the shout-outs there at the end. These are some great folks and some great podcasts. If people aren't listening, they should check out Geek Gab. They should check out Power Users, all the ones mentioned there. I just want to make a couple comments on your comments. I totally agree on the camera and the slow-mo. Absolutely in love with the camera on my iPhone 5S. I did want to follow up. I commented that my only complaint on the slow-mo feature was that exporting the actual slow-mo video with the slow-mo effect embedded from your phone is really tricky. You cannot get it out of there because they just sort of keep the markers. It records at 120 frames per second, and when you pull it off, if you just pull it directly off of the phone, what you get is you get 120 frame per second video without the slow motion effect in your video. And what I really want is the slow motion effect, but I want the HD quality. Well, a developer contacted me who just put out a free app called True Slow-Mo, TruSlomo, and all the app does is let you access your 120 frame per second videos and export them at the full HD resolution for sharing or saving back to the camera roll, but with your slow motion effect rendered in place on that video. So, you know, basically taking the 120 frame per second and rendering it back out in HD at 30 frames a second, so you get that cool slow-mo effect. Now, the only problem with the app right now is that if you've used the slow motion feature on the iPhone 5S, the way it works is you shoot your video at 120 frames, and then you get a little editor where you can set the in and out point for where you want to start and stop the slow motion effect. The slow-mo app doesn't pick up on that. It basically just takes the standard in and out points that the video sets, which are just a few seconds in on either end, and it only uses those. And I talked to the developer about it. He said basically he doesn't know if he can even get access to those edit points from the camera roll. He's looking into it maybe for a future version, but the version right now when you go to export, it's just pretty much the slow-mo effect across your entire video. But even that is cool enough because you can take that clip and then throw it into iMovie or bring it into iMovie on the iPhone and actually use your slow-motion video. That was the most frustrating thing to me is you have the video in the camera roll. You want to use it. You want to use the slow motion effect in iMovie on your iOS device, but you can't do it because it's not rendered there in the clip. And iMovie on iOS, at least right now, until Apple puts out an update, doesn't have a slow motion effect. You can bring it back and do it on the desktop, but you can't do it there. But I totally agree, Gavin. The camera and the slow mo is very, very cool. I also 100% agree on the iPhone 5C. I saw in the wild, I got to play with them at the Apple Store on launch day, but I saw my first iPhone 5C in the wild sighting this week, a blue iPhone 5C, and they look gorgeous. And this is the thing, your reaction to it, my reaction to it, this is what's going to happen over the holiday season. The public, they're going to go into Apple stores, they're going to go into their carrier stores, they're going to go into their big box stores, and they're going to see these devices and fall in love with them. I know the media kind of panned it and has been a little bit down on the 5C, but I think consumers are absolutely just going to love these devices. And you know, Apple needs to have the premium quality, the metal, and they need to have those obvious differences. So we know why they didn't just, you know, pack the iPhone 5S innards in a 5C case. But I'm with you. I think moving forward, a lot of people aren't going to mind the plastic enclosures and actually prefer them in some cases. So totally agree with your comments there. I also agree. I love the Apple case. I got the leather Apple case for my iPhone 5C. I think it's gorgeous. I love the feel of it. But the bloody holes, that's how you say it, right? The bloody holes on that thing are too darn small. Apple always does this. So I can only use Apple's charging cable with, you know, the lightning cable, because it's got a small enough end. I've got these great cables that I got from Amazon that were cheaper than the Apple ones. I can't use those with the case on my new iPhone 5. And then the headphones, it's only Apple's headphones, or I've got to go back to using the adapter that I got with my original iPhone so that I can use another set of headphones with that case. And taking that case on and off is not easy, so I never want to take it off. So that aside, I absolutely do love the Apple case. I don't know how much protection it will afford, but it's certainly thin, and that's what I appreciate, is I don't like big, heavy cases. So really appreciate your feedback and your comments on the 5S and 5C, and glad you were able to score one just a couple days after launch. Another thing we talked about recently on the MacCast was some of the privacy issues, specifically with the contacts. I was talking about, in this case, specifically Siri being able to, if you have Siri activated on lock screen, divulge a lot of the private information that's in your Mi card, in your address book card, things like your phone number and your birth date and your spouse's name or maybe your kid's name. All that data that's in that card is made available publicly. And if you go to share your card on an iOS device, you have no way to mark fields as private. Actually, on the desktop version of Contacts, you can go in and you can set up fields and say, okay, when I share my V card or my card from Contacts, don't share these fields. Unfortunately, you can only do it for your card. And my comments on that elicited this comment from Mike.
Hey, Adam, this is Mike Pettengill. So, Adam, I was calling you about your what you said on October 1st regarding setting privacy controls for Contacts. I would really like that, because I've run into this occasionally where I want to give someone, a friend of mine who's a doctor's number professionally for something they need, but I have a bunch of private information, his own cell phone that's not his office cell phone, his address, all that stuff on there, so I can't really just send them the contact. I just end up doing a bunch of cutting and pasting, so it would be really convenient to be able to set privacy settings, but still be able to send, you know, an e-card that's just the public information. So it'd be really great if Apple does take on adding those privacy settings to our personal stuff. If they'd extend it to the whole address book, because it's really useful when we want to share someone else's information and I have more stuff in there and I have notes about their family or whatever. So I just want to throw that out there. Thanks.
Hey, I couldn't agree more with that idea. And that got me thinking, you know, there's got to be an app for that, right? Somebody must have thought of this before. There's a third-party app out there that we're missing, right? Please tell me that that's the case. If you happen to know if there is a third-party app that will take the contacts database, which is one of those things that is accessible with permissions, you see it all the time, right? You open up an app, it says this app would like access to your contacts. You say okay, and it can pull in that data and information. So I can't imagine that somebody hasn't created an app specifically for sharing contact information, but in the process, stripping out and creating a new version, a one-off version of a V card with just specific fields highlighted. I have to imagine that that's out there. So if you know of that app, shoot me an email, shoot me an audio comment, let us know, and let us know which one's good. There's probably multiple ones. The key here is probably finding the one that is really good and integrates really, really well and does what we want it to do. But thanks, Mike, for just even putting the seed of the idea into my mind, and hopefully we'll find a solution for the community here. We'll do a little crowdsourcing. I want to now specifically talk to those of you in the UK. Apparently, you have a new capability in your BBC iPlayer radio app, and it sounds like it could be cool. It could also be completely lame, and I'm now really curious because I don't think we can get the BBC iPlayer radio app in the States. I don't think you can get it outside of the UK, but apparently they added podcast support into the app. According to an executive producer over there, he was saying that it was one of the most requested features. The app will let you download and listen to your favorite shows offline. I guess that's a feature that was recently added also for video content, the ability to download and play that content offline. In the past, apparently, you had to stream it or be connected. So I'm going to ask you in the UK audience, how are podcasts in the iPlayer app? What kinds of features does it have? Does it have a directory? Is it just simply bare bones? Do you have to put your stuff in there? I want to hear a review. I want to know somebody, how does it compare to Apple's app? How does it compare to some of the third-party apps that are out there? Did they do a good job with it? Please send in your review. Audio review would be great if you can keep it short, just a couple minutes. Let us know your thoughts on it. I would really appreciate that. But I was cool to see that story. I think it's nice to have just one app where you can get your TV shows, you can get your videos, and now you can get your podcasts in there as well. Also, I think it does, you know, your radio stations too, right? So an all-in-one media player app. You don't have to go to multiple sources or places. Sounds cool to me, but, you know, maybe, I guess it's all in the implementation. Did they do a good job? So let us know. Another big question I'm getting now that we're on the cusp of OS X Mavericks coming out, I think I told you earlier, it's already gone Gold Master. No one knows for sure exactly when Apple's going to put it out, but we're expecting it in the next couple weeks. Apple said the fall, so we're getting toward the end of the time frame for Apple to put it out. But a lot of people have been asking me a couple different questions about Mavericks, and the biggest one probably that I'm getting a lot is, will I be able to run Mavericks on my system? What are the system requirements? Now, as a general rule, we're not going to know until Apple actually, you know, announces the product and announces the ship date and tells us. But we also know that the version that goes out as Gold Master is supposed to be the one that's hitting the streets. So we have details on what the Gold Master version will run on. And it comes down to most likely anything that can currently run Mountain Lion should be able to run Mavericks with very few exceptions. Specifically, that's going to be your iMacs mid-2007 and newer, your MacBooks, those are the late 2008 aluminum ones or the early 2009 or newer, MacBook Pros mid to late 2007 and newer, the Xserve, if you have one of those, early 2009 and newer, MacBook Airs starting at late 2008 models and up, Mac Minis early 2009 and newer, and also the Mac Pros early 2008 and newer models. If you have one of those, you're very likely going to be able to run Mavericks no problem. As far as memory requirements, Mavericks will apparently run on a machine with just 2 gigabytes of RAM. I would think you'd want at least 4 gigabytes, and the more RAM, the better. I run 8 gigabytes on most of my machines these days, and I think I'm looking toward the future at getting at least 16 moving forward. So I would, you know, don't go lower than 4 gigabytes. I think you'd be suffering a little bit at 2 gigabytes, but if you absolutely want to run it at that, it supposedly is supported. The other big question that I'm getting asked is, hey, I didn't go and upgrade to Mountain Lion. I'm still running Lion or maybe even Snow Leopard. Am I going to be able to directly upgrade right to OS X Mavericks, or am I going to have to buy Mountain Lion now and then upgrade along the way? And the answer to that is, we don't know again for sure, but most likely you're going to be able to directly upgrade to OS X Mavericks from Snow Leopard or Lion. Basically, if you have the Mac App Store, because you'll buy and download it through the Mac App Store, and that would be anybody running 10.6.8 Snow Leopard or later, because that was the release where they added the Mac App Store. If you have the Mac App Store, you should be able to buy and install OS X Mavericks. I don't think that's going to be a problem as long as you meet the system requirements. And then somewhat related to that, and the last question I was getting asked a lot is, hey, I have an older system. It's not going to support Mavericks, but it runs Mountain Lion or even Lion. Am I still going to be able to get Mountain Lion after OS X Mavericks is released? Am I going to be able to go on the App Store and buy Mountain Lion? If the short answer to that is Apple generally pulls the older versions from the store. So if you are running Lion, you want to upgrade to Mountain Lion and you haven't bought it yet, you probably do want to go on and buy it now. If you already purchased Mountain Lion from the App Store, then you should be able to continue to download it from the App Store just like you can Lion. A lot of people don't know this, but if you upgraded to Mountain Lion and you still want to go back and get a copy of Lion and you don't see it in the Mac App Store, so when you go into the store and you look at your purchased software, you might not see it in the list. If you don't, then go under the store menu in the App Store app and go to View My Account. You're going to have to enter your Apple ID username and a password. But once you authenticate and you bring up the panel, the account information screen, there's a section called iTunes in the Cloud. Under that section, there's a little Manage link. If you click on that, you'll see your older software. You should see Lion in there. It's probably hidden, and there's a little button you can press to unhide Lion, and then it will show back up in the list of that purchases tab. So then you can re-download it, you can reinstall it. So you can get that software back. I would imagine Mountain Lion's going to be the same way when Mavericks comes out. So Mavericks will be visible in the store. You won't be able to buy Mountain Lion, but if you've bought it in the past, you should be able to go back into your prior purchases and reinstall that. So don't worry about that. But if you haven't purchased Mountain Lion yet and you want a copy of it, get a copy before Apple releases Mavericks because it might not be available in the Mac App Store. And the other recommendation I would make to you is make a USB recovery disk of your Mountain Lion or your Lion installer. Get an 8 gigabyte or larger USB stick. I think you can get them pretty cheap these days. And then download and run Apple's OS X Recovery Disk Assistant version 1.0. You just run the app. It will create a bootable USB stick for you, and then you'll just have a hard copy. You know, put that in a drawer somewhere where you can find it, and then you'll just have a hard copy installer should you ever need it. And I'll have a link to that software, the OS X Recovery Disk Assistant software, in the show notes at maccast.com if you need to get a copy of that. But those are some of the answers to a lot of the questions you've been asking me about OS X Mavericks. And then the last thing that I have for you this week is a cool little tip. Actually, a couple cool little tips. If you've got a 5S, an iPhone 5S, and you're using the Touch ID system, you probably know by now that when you set up your fingerprints, you go into Settings, you go under General, you go into Passcode and Fingerprint, and then you can add different fingerprints. So when you first go through the wizard and set up your phone, you set up one finger, but if you want to add additional fingers, you can add up to five different fingers. And when you do that, they're labeled by default finger one, finger two. And when you go into the settings and you're looking, it's not very helpful in identifying which finger is assigned to sort of which slot in the setup. And so here's a couple cool tips to help you figure out what's going on. First is that if you're on that screen, if you've gone into the passcode and fingerprint screen, and you just simply touch your finger to the Touch ID sensor while you're on that screen, it'll actually highlight in gray the finger that's assigned to, the slot that finger is assigned to. It'll kind of come up, it'll fade, you know, show it in gray and then fade out so you can see which one is there. But more importantly, and I didn't realize this was not obvious at all, but I found a tip that said you can actually change the label. It doesn't have to just say finger one, finger two. It seems like when you set it up, there's no way to change that, but you actually can change it. So again, on that same screen, if you tap the edit button in the upper right-hand corner of the screen, you get the little red delete circles, and it looks like you can just delete fingerprints. But if you actually tap the label area, the keyboard will slide up and you can actually assign a custom label to that slot. And once again, if you don't know which finger that's assigned to, just simply put your finger on the Touch ID sensor. It will light up. It will highlight it. And you can say, oh, that's that one. And you can change and assign your label. Hit done. And now you'll be able to better control and better understand which fingers are assigned to which slots for your Touch ID sensor. So some cool, very helpful tips for your iPhone 5S and fingerprint scanning. But with that, that is going to do it for the MacCast for this week. I'm actually going to be leaving on vacation. I'm going to be out for the next week, but I've already put together and have a new MacCast for you. It should be coming out probably on Sunday or Monday. I got Josh DeLioncourt on, friend of the MacCast. It's been a couple of years since we had him on. He does the MacCessibility Roundtable podcast and also the MacCessibility website. He knows all about the assistive technologies, the universal access technologies that are in Apple products. He's actually a programmer. He's worked in the field for years. Great guy, and I got him on to talk about all of the new iOS 7 accessibility features. So really fun time, great episode. So look forward to that. But that's going to do it for the show for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, and Disc Label for your Mac, also PDF Pen for your iPhone and iPad, as well as Text Expander Touch for your iOS devices. And they have a brand new application for iOS, PDF Pen Scan Plus. This is really cool. You can use it to create PDFs and to OCR stuff, scan stuff in right from your iOS device. It's available on the App Store. They have more information on their website, so check that out. It's just $4.99 right now, so jump in on that. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. Also, Transporter by Connected Data. You can get all the benefits of cloud storage, but with the control and security and privacy of a physical hard drive or NAS, you can get 10% off a Transporter by using the offer code MacCast. Just head over to filetransporter.com/MacCast. You can get all the details and information on the Transporter. Really cool product. Gazelle, it's the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets online. Find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And Squarespace, it's the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, online portfolio, or blog. You can get a free trial and 10% off your account by going to squarespace.com and using the offer code MACCAST10. Squarespace, everything you need to create an exceptional website. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Big thank you to you for your support. Please keep your emails, your audio comments coming. I love hearing from you. You can send your emails to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-I-AM-9, and you can leave voicemail there. You can also leave voicemail on Skype. My Skype address is the MacCast. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the forum. And if you'd like to follow me online, I'm on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And don't forget to check out the MacCast Google Plus community. Lots of cool conversations and tips and cool stuff being posted online in all the various places where we all hang out. So come hang out with us. And until next time, we will talk to you all again real soon.